The time is now 12 o'clock. We previously called the meeting to order at 10:30 a.m. and recessed into executive session to discuss one litigation item pursuant to RCW 42.30.110. No votes or actions were taken. Present with me today are Commissioners McCarthy, Marzano, Meyer, myself, and Commissioner Petridge is excused. To begin with, you please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Commissioner, can we revise the executive session started at 11?
Oh, it did. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Next thing on our agenda is the consent agenda. There's three items on the consent agenda: the minutes of June 13th, the check wire certifications, and the WJR/CalBag sublease agreement. Any concerns or questions about the consent agenda?
Yes, Vice President Johnson. I'd like to separate item C, the WJR/CalBag sublease agreement. I have some questions with regard to that. Other than that, I have no objection to including the minutes of June 13th and the check wire certification on the consent agenda. Several of the questions I had with regard to the check wire certification were answered by a subsequent memo of staff, and I appreciate that. So I would move that we accept and approve the consent agenda items A and B alone.
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. And for the audience at hand, when we look at the consent agenda, any one of the commissioners can ask for a single item to be removed from the consent agenda and discussed during our meeting. So that's our policy for a lot of years. So what we have is a motion and a second for the June 13 minutes and the check wire certification. Any comments from the commission? Any comments from the audience? Hearing none, all those in favor of certifying the consent agenda that I described, please say aye.
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 Anybody against, say nay. Okay, it passes. Let's talk about the WJR/CalBag sublease. And that's going to be, who's going to present that? Scott Francis, are you going to talk about that, please? Just review that. This is an agreement between two people who lease from us two different properties.
Correct.
Please.
Yes. Currently, WJR, they have a 5.43-acre lease. They've had that lease since 1996.
Can you speak up just a little bit? You're hard to hear.
Okay.
Thank you.
WJR, they have a...
There, so we can hear better? Does that mic have... I can't hear it.
I couldn't hear that either, hardly.
I couldn't.
How's this? Better?
Better.
It's better. Okay. Not excellent, but better.
Yeah. Okay, I'll speak up. WJR, they've been a tenant of the Ports since 1996 on a property off of Marine View Drive. They have 5.43 acres leased there for metal recycling business. They also own the building on that property. They would like to sublease that same property to CalBag Metals, which is an affiliate company of theirs. The primary lease remains intact. It has no change. The same business is there, the same operation is there. They're still responsible for all the terms of the primary lease. It's just a sublease for them, which is basically for tax purposes.
You said for tax purposes?
Right.
Okay.
They have, the way they're set up, WJR owns their assets, and then CalBag is more of their operating arm. And we've had leases with both entities for many years. They have an adjacent property that's leased. It's 3.31 acres, and that is leased directly with CalBag Metals now. So with this sublease, both of them would be leased by CalBag Metals. However, the existing base lease remains intact, and they're still responsible for all the terms of the lease, and nothing changes from the port standpoint.
Yeah, let's do this. If I can get a motion to approve that in a second, and then we'll bring up some questions. Can I hear a motion?
I move we approve the action requested.
Second.
Okay, I got a motion and a second. Let's talk about anybody, any commissioner with questions?
Some more questions. So the CalBag lease for 5.43, that lease, though, goes all the way to 2046, according to your memo, with one 30-year extension, whereas, as I understand your memo, this 3.31-acre lease by WJR, which you're asking to assign, is going to expire in 2023 with 4 or 5 year mutually approved extensions. Is that correct?
I need to clarify a couple items there. It's the 5.43 acre lease that's currently leased by WJR, and they're requesting a sublease to CalBag.
I see. So that memo is correct on it's the 5.43 acres, the one that WJR has.
Is that correct. What you just said? They currently have that lease. They would be subleasing to CalBag.
Right.
And then the adjacent property, which is 3.31 acres, right, that is currently leased directly to CalBag Metals.
I see. So,
and both of them are entities of the same company.
I'll reverse the names in the memo here then. But am I correct about the time? The one lease with WJR goes to 2046 then?
Correct. It was a 50-year lease that was that started in 1996,
right,
and it would go to 2046.
Whereas the other lease then with CalBag goes to 2023. Is that correct?
Correct. And then there's, as I remember, there's 3 5-year extensions on that.
And is the same type of operation conducted on both properties?
Exactly the same operation. They operate both all total of 8+ acres. As the same operation, their metal recycling right business.
So there's no effort to extend the 2023 lease other than that was set forth in the original agreement by this assignment?
Correct. The 3.31-acre lease on the adjacent property, there's no change in that at all.
All right.
And our base lease on the 5.43 acres, it remains intact. There's no change to that. This just allows them to have a sublease to another entity, which is underneath their umbrella.
I see. Okay, those are the questions I had. As a matter of principle, I just think that any time we have property lease in the tide flats, that we ought to bring it before the public for transparency purposes and not have it within our consent agenda. We have so much attention through the sub-area planning process and by others about all the property that we have and what it's used for in the tide flats and leases that we have. So I just think these things always need to be anything involving property in the tide flats needs to be an agenda item and a presentation in case anyone from the audience has a question about it or a comment about it. In principle, I think that's the principle I'd like to adhere to. I think you've answered my questions, though, as to this assignment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments from the commission? So just to summarize what we said, we're going to, if we pass this, this has no impact on the port whatsoever.
No impact at all. The base lease remains intact. The terms remain intact. The same parties will be on the property doing the same business. It has no impact.
Very good. Any comments or questions from the audience? Hearing none, we have a motion and a second on the floor for this proposal. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anybody against, say nay. All right, it passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now is the time in our agenda. We have two times in the public can speak. We open the floor for the public to speak now, and the public has an opportunity to speak on any agenda item that comes up later in the day. So I got nobody signed up for public speaking. Is there anybody who wants to say anything now on the general topic or anything? Hearing none, let's go to our next phase, which is action agenda. David Morrison, we're going to talk about refunding bonds.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you very much. I'm here today to offer for your consideration 4 bond resolutions. Before I start, let me, for the record, introduce myself. I'm David Morrison. I am the treasurer for the Port of Tacoma. In the audience today, supporting me is Cynthia Weed from K&L Gates, our bond counsel.
Welcome.
And additionally, Peter Schellenberger, our partner with Public Financial Management Financial Advisors. He is our senior financial advisor on our financial issues. So they're both here. I appreciate their support and work that they've helped me on these resolutions and this presentation. So thank you. So what are we doing? Why am I here? I have two requests for new resolutions and two requests to amend existing resolutions to address existing subordinate lien revenue bond opportunities. And I'm going to walk through those opportunities with you. The proposed actions will not increase overall port debt outstanding. I want to make that clear. In fact, it may reduce it, and we'll get into that in a minute. My purpose here is to reduce risk and eliminate a known increase in interest expenses caused by changes to the U.S. tax code. So I'm not promising you savings. But it's about risk reduction and the potential for savings. Okay. There are four pages of walls of words, and I'm not going to go through them, but there are four resolutions. One is for a brand new 2019 senior lien bond. That's a new resolution. The second is for a subordinate lien, a brand new subordinate lien revenue refunding bond. So we're taking an existing bond and splitting it, one going to the senior level as fixed rate, one remaining subordinate level at the subordinate lien level. Okay, that's these first two wall of words. And you all have had the resolutions and had a chance to look at them. The third and fourth resolutions are amendments to existing resolutions, and they're minor changes. They don't result in a refunding of the bonds technically from an IRS, but they're going to give us flexibility in the future, and I'll get into that in a minute. Okay. So with your permission, I'll move on and get into the details. So here's the current situation. The port has approximately $41.6 million of subordinate lien revenue refunding bonds outstanding, more than we need to match our interest rate swaps. And I'm going to show some pictures in a few pages. That amount of unhedged debt will grow over the years, and I'll show you. It's going to grow quite a bit by the time we get to 2044. It's $122 million, but we have plans for that out in the 2030 timeframe. But it grows over time, and in 5 years, 6 years, it will be about $51 million. So my clicker, there it is. So when we, with our financial advisor, we look at the market conditions allow the port to refund portions of the 2014A subordinate lien bonds, specifically the 2020 through the 2030 maturities and a portion of the 2031 maturity, which are currently at variable rates. We can go lock those in as senior lien bonds at a fixed rate at really historically low rates for 12-year bonds, okay? This is a risk reduction strategy. I'm not going to be able to lock in 10-year or 12-year rates at the same rate as weekly traded variable rate bonds as they are today. But there's no promise as to where those variable rate bonds will be 1 year, 2 year, tomorrow. And so this is risk reduction. We could forego lower interest payments by fixing out this debt over time. And in 10 years, we can come back and report out what we've done. And if I've done the wrong thing, you can fire me, I guess. It's a 10-year deal.
That's assuming we're here, David.
Yes, it's commissioner.
We'll get arrogant.
Yeah.
So in this slide, I'm going to show you our swap versus our variable rate. And for those in the interest, we've entered into agreements to pay a fixed rate to our swap partners and receive a variable rate. And I'll show some pictures in a few slides. And then we pay variable rate to our bonds. And it basically takes our subordinate lien bonds, which are variable rate, and fixes them out. Today, the swap line has a notional amount that will decrease over time. And by 2042 goes to zero, our swaps go away. Our variable rate bonds, you can see, have a different glide path and eventually settle out at the $122 million bond, which matures in 2044. That gap today is $41 million. Okay? What we would do is we would close that gap now. We would take that $41 million, fix it out at basically historically low rates. Today, we have two series of bonds, our 2014A and 2014B senior bonds at about 2.5% money. I think we'll end up, if you approve this, at between 2.25% and 2.5% money. So again, it's really low financing, and we're addressing this gap between the bonds. So I've talked about historical rate bonds. Our subordinate lien bonds are single A bonds, A1, A+. Our senior lien bonds are AA3
bonds, and this graph shows, and they're AMT bonds, alternative minimum tax. What that means is the holder of these bonds, the interest they receive is subject to alternative minimum tax if they pay it. But if they're not subject to AMT, these bonds are tax exempt to the bondholders. So there's an advantage to the bondholders having AMT bonds.
On this slide, the first point is January 2009. If we went back to 2000, the year 2000,
these would be higher. I think they would be higher.
The drop in interest rate substantially as compared to, because this doesn't represent, this represents current history, not the past 20 years.
That's correct.
Which is substantially higher.
But I think I wanted to compare it to a 10-year history, because I could go back 50 years.
I just want to make the point that 2.2% is not a long-term health situation.
It moves up and down, obviously. It's trended down over time, but you can see very few times has it been below 2% interest, and now there's cost in total. So when I talk about total cost, I'm going to include the cost of issuance. But the actual rates we can get are around 2%, yeah. And it's about as low as it's been in the 10-year period. So in fact, the 10-year average is 2.9, almost 3% over this time period. The max was 4.7%. The minimum is 1.9% over those 10 years. And as to July 2nd, we were at 2.0%. So you can see, again, we're very, very close to the minimum. And we've had over a 1% drop over the last 365 days. Okay? So again, these are just the rates. They don't include the cost of issuance. In the binder that I sent, you had the cost of issuance, and we can talk about that in a few slides. So, assuming approval of refunding of the $41.6 million as senior bonds, so I'm moving it from subordinate to the senior level because we get better rates when we move to the senior. And just a little bit of history I should have included. The 2014A subordinate lien bonds that we're refunding were originally the 2004 and 2005 senior bonds. So we had to move them down to the subordinate lien in 2014 to match our swaps. We didn't want to issue more debt. So I'm just moving a little back up to the senior lien level, okay? So assuming we approve that, the port will have $22.7 million of subordinate lien bonds matched to the swaps. Now, in the resolution, the second resolution, I asked for the ability to issue bonds up to $90 million. We're not adding debt, but if market conditions are not right, say the 10-year rate goes up to 3% when we want to go to market, I'm not going to recommend we do that. I would keep the bonds as subordinate lien. So that's why that $90 million, we're not adding debt. It gives us flexibility to respond to market conditions on the day we go to sell the bonds, okay? So if they're not favorable, we're going to keep those as subordinate lien. Why are we doing this? Well, due to tax code changes, the current mode of bond causes approximately $500,000 per year in additional interest on the full $280 million of variable rate bonds that we have outstanding today. So I presented to you in March, and it's available for the public to review, a presentation on our debt. And I'm going to just talk a few slides here. So we are the Port of Tacoma. We have with our counterparties some agreements to trade interest rates. And this was a way to fix out fixed interest rates in the future that we couldn't do through normal bonds. So we pay something called 70% of LIBOR, which is an industry standard, London Interbank Offer Rate, and it's in US dollars. And we receive a floating rate. We pay a fixed rate. We receive 70% of LIBOR as a variable rate that's reset every month. And with our bonds, since these bonds were issued, the 2014A bonds were issued in 2014, and with our other subordinate lien bonds until late last year, we paid 70% of LIBOR to the banks. So there was a historical match, so we had really fixed rate bonds, okay? What happened with the tax code change was that the banks believed that the interest they received became less valuable. There was less of a tax break. So they moved to 80% of LIBOR. So you can see there's a 10% of LIBOR difference. And if LIBOR is at 2%, we're talking about what's called 20 basis points, or 21/20 of a percent. Multiply that by $280 million, you're gonna get over $500,000 a year in extra cost. That's fixed out, right? It's a known difference. So what we're proposing to do is to take these away from the banks and go issue it in the public market to bondholders. And we believe that the market rate we will pay is much closer to 70% of LIBOR than the 80% of LIBOR that we've been paying. So let me give you some busy graphs, and I'll do my best to explain this. So SIFMA, and what is SIFMA? It's the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association index of seven-day traded paper. So it's variable rate paper. And you can see it is very volatile over time, and it's been increasing since 2014. But you'll see in historical, it's pretty low. It's the brown line. And historically, the 70% of LIBOR has trended very much like SIFMA. There's days it's higher, it's days it's lower. But it's a better trend than what we've marked in 80% of LIBOR. So you're building this gap, and that's what I'm trying to eliminate. It's costing us extra money. Historically, here's SIFMA, and you can see the short-term rates, Commissioner Johnson, as you mentioned, prior to 2009, interest rates were much higher. The short-term daily rates were almost 4% in 2007. We had our layman's moment in 2009, and a huge spike in variable rate bonds. Converting some of our subordinate lien bonds to fixed eliminates that risk, right? And who knows, that could have lasted longer. We're looking at a short period of time. You see the short-term rates went basically to zero. We're all familiar with that. And then it's been climbing ever since. Now let's look at history of SIFMA to 1 month LIBOR. Remember, we're currently, the banks were paying 80% of LIBOR, but historically it's been at 70% of LIBOR, and that's what we're trying to get back, to get back to SIFMA, to stop paying that extra 10% of LIBOR. And in fact, the ratio here has jumped up over the last year and a half from over one to as low as 50%. So it's been very volatile. But on average, you can see since the tax reform, it's at 70%. So that's what I'm trying to lock in. So why am I here? The original resolution for the 2014A subordinate lien bonds only allowed one mode of interest payment, and that was the index interest rates where the bank owned it. So we need to revise that resolution, make it the new 2019 subordinate lien bonds to allow us to go sell these bonds to bondholders. The current resolutions for the 2008 and 2008B bonds allow staff to change modes of interest as needed, the current 2008 and 2008B subordinate lien bond resolutions allow all the bonds to only be in one mode at the one time. But given that graph where they have different timing of the bonds for the swaps to the bonds, I want to be able to, in the future, maybe have some of the bonds be subordinate variable and fix some out in the future. So this allows parts of the 2008 and 2008B bonds to be variable and part to be in another mode, whatever we need to get the lowest interest cost. So delegation and resolutions. Commission is delegating the refunding of the 2014A subordinate lien revenue refunding bonds into two new series. The senior lien revenue refunding bonds 2019 fixed rate AMT bonds is our proposal. And the subordinate lien revenue refunding bonds 2019, they'll be very variable rate, multimodal, meaning I can have different types of interest depending on what we can do to lower cost, and alternative minimum tax. And I explained to you why we were asking for $90 million of authorization. We are not issuing additional bonds. That's just to cover us in case we decide not to fix it out based on market conditions the day we go to market. Getting more specific on the delegation of authority, the commission is delegating to us the manner of sale, negotiated or competitive. Our plan is to go competitive. So the morning we offer the bonds, banks will bid on those bonds and we'll get the lowest cost. We have the flexibility to go negotiate it in case there's a displacement in the market. There's another bankruptcy, there's issues, there's war, and we're ready to go. And we may need to go work with a bank to get the bonds placed, but that's not our intent. Our intent is to go with a competitive sale. The terms and conditions are subject to a maximum par value. We're not changing maturity dates. Principal amounts may go down. So we may issue these bonds as premium bonds. So current market rates may be 2%, but bondholders like a bigger coupon. They like a 5% coupon. So we may issue, depending on the bids from the banks, we may issue, say, $38 million of debt to refund $41 million of debt, but they'll be at 5% coupons versus the going rate of 2. Cash flow is the same. It's just whether it's hitting interest expense or principal of the bonds. And we have, when we did the 2016 bonds, you'll remember we issued those as premium bonds. Okay. So that's what you're delegating to us on the senior lien bonds and the ability to pay all fees and execute all documents associated with the fundings. And you saw the resolutions. I gave you a copy of, for example, the official statement for the senior bonds. And we are working on the remarketing circulars for the subordinate lien bonds. And I'll give you copies just for your information when those are available. On the subordinate lien rebonds, same delegation. We have manner of sale as negotiated or competitive. We are doing a competitive sale. We have issued an RFP for letter of credit providers. We've received 8 bids. We also issued an RFP for our remarketing agents, and we received 9 bids. And so we're working through those today. Additional delegations is the maturity dates, principal amounts, interest rates and modes, and timing of sale. We're not changing any of the maturity of the subordinate lien bonds at all. And you're also delegating to us the ability to pay fees and execute all documents associated with these bonds. So in summary, and on the commission is approving modifications to the 2008 and the 2008B resolutions to allow different bond modes at the same time. I mentioned that earlier. So our team, I introduced Cynthia Weed from K&L Gates. They've been our bond counsel since long, since before I was here. So I've been working with Cynthia for 14 years. Our financial advisor, Peter, has been our financial advisor for 7 or 8 years. And prior to that, it was PFM as well. But now the president of PFM was our financial advisor, and he took on that role. And Peter's been a great financial advisor since then. As I mentioned, our senior lien bond underwriter will be determined on the day we go to market, right, by competitive bid. Our subordinate lien underwriter remarketer is based on the RFP results that we're reviewing today. Our subordinate lien letter of credit provider, again, will be based on the RFP results. The total estimated transaction cost for this is $1 million. About $800,000 for the subordinate lien bonds, including rating agencies, bond counsel, disclosure counsel, and port counsel. And our senior costs are about $300,000. Okay. So if you just look at the subordinate lien bonds, the payback will be about a year, year and a half, based on the performance of SIFMA compared to the 80% LIBOR that we've been paying. Really, on the senior cost, I'm not saving you money. I'm doing, if you agree with the proposal, a risk reduction. Right. So that's the proposal on the senior bonds. So I'm here to recommend approval of the 4 resolutions that have been presented to you. And I'm available for questions.
Thank you, David. I'm going to ask a question legal. Can we take these all at one time?
Yes.
May I hear a motion for...
I recommend we approve the resolutions 2019-07, 2019-08, 2019-09, and 2019-10 as presented for purposes of discussion.
Second.
A motion and a second. Questions from the commission. Eric, did you have a comment?
For the record, Eric Johnson, Executive Director of the Port. I want the commission to know that I've gone through this packet of information very carefully. I read that entire, most of that entire big binder that you got, including the footnotes. And then I met with David and some of his staff about a week and a half ago, I believe, and dove into this in some depth, asked a lot of questions, and convinced myself that this was a prudent course of action. So if you want my recommendation, it is to go forward with this. In my opinion, the easiest way to summarize it is that you're laying off some risk and locking in a lower interest rate, a historically low rate, for the next 10 years. If interest rates stay below 2% for the next 10 years, then this was David's idea. But if they go if they go higher than 2% in the next 10 years, then it was my idea. But he did it. They've gone into this very carefully, and the bond issuance costs will be essentially paid back, if you want to think of it that way, in about 2 years. So we're not really incurring significant bond reissuance costs. It's a complicated package because there's so many different things going on here. But you know, when you really dive into it, that's how I think of it. And I also asked if this would in any way materially impact the financial obligations that the port has committed to in its larger alliance role. And the answer was no, it will not affect your commitments in that capacity. So having learned that and gone through these numbers, it's my recommendation that you proceed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions from the commission?
I'd like to ask David a couple of questions. First of all, kind of stepping back, because really what you're doing is you're trying to manage our overall portfolio of debt, fixed rate versus variable rate, and the risk associated with the variable rate. So if we follow with what these four resolutions are essentially being proposed to do, what kind of a mix do we have between fixed rate overall debt versus a variable rate?
It's going to be mainly because of the swaps, and I go back to that chart, it's going to be mainly fixed right now because we've matched the swaps to the variable rate outstanding in 2019. Okay. And then that will grow over time to more and more variable. So it will be in the probably the low two or threes in the next couple of years, and then it will grow over time, and we'll have to take more action in the future. So let me go back.
But David, my question really is, from a portfolio standpoint, is that by following this recommendation you have on the table here, what, you know, normally I'm looking for the fact that you normally always want to have in your portfolio maybe a little bit of variable rate as a way to hedge whatever it is in terms of interest rates. So if we implement on this, what percent of our overall portfolio debt will be in a variable rate mode?
For the first couple of years, a very low percentage. I'd say
that'll be that 2%?
Yeah. So okay. Look at the graph here, Commissioner. So I'm basically matching, but by 2025, I think I've got another 10 million versus outstanding debt of 400. So it's a very small percentage. It's going to be in the 3-5%. But over time, we're going to be say by 2030, it will be about 10 to 15%. So for the foreseeable future, it's going to be a low percentage.
Okay, which leads me to the question then is that, okay, 15% of our overall portfolio is going to be variable rate out here in the fairly near future. Why wouldn't we want to consider going with more fixed rate at this stage?
Well, I could not fix out more because I always have to have more. I have to have at least as much variable rate bonds to match the swaps.
We're in this swap issue.
That's correct. I cannot fix out more. I wish I could, but I cannot. I'm sorry.
Because I kind of come from the viewpoint that, gosh, if the overall fixed rates are that good, why aren't we fixing this? Because what you're really telling me is I got an exposure here going into the future.
That's right. And then what I'm requesting is the ability to close this gap in the future when the interest rates are correct. And so if in 5 years interest rates are similar, I can take portions of the 2008.
So you can close that gap again.
Right. I would hope that this stair step and be closer if interest rates are good. Right. Now, if in 3 years fixed rate 10-year bonds are 5%, and subordinate lien weekly are 0.5%, I wouldn't recommend this. We debated whether to bring this forward to you, and when the interest rates were increasing, I wouldn't have brought the fixing out the senior bonds at 3%. I'd do it at 2.5 and 2, but I wouldn't do it at 3. There's just too much of a gap. So we will take action based on what's going on with interest rates in the future to close that gap if it's economically advantageable. Advantage to the port. Did that answer your question?
I think so. I guess I'm frustrated because if the fixed rates are doggone good, why can't we fix as much as we can?
State law on the swaps.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the whole swap issue, as far as I'm concerned, which that's a term I hope I never have to hear about again at some future point in time.
It is what it is.
2042.
Let me also ask you, in terms of when you talk about senior lien and subordinate lien and those sorts of hierarchies, what determines the level for us of saying, well, wait a minute, why don't we move from a subordinate lien up to all senior lien? Why wouldn't we want to do that?
When you have debt service coverage requirements, which are different between the senior lien and the subordinate lien. So having subordinate bonds gives you flexibility if you're not doing as well economically as you wanted. Senior lien bond reserve requires a 1.35 times debt service coverage after paying all your debt and requires a senior reserve. So we're going to have to put about $4 million more of our free cash into our senior reserve, and we'll get that back when these bonds mature over time. The subordinate lien bonds require a 1x debt service coverage. And so it's about, again, having two liens gives, in my mind, risk mitigation and based on the performance of the port, and gives you flexibility in that. And I don't know, Peter, if you have any comments about the mix between senior and subordinate.
I think I understand the debt service coverage. What I am wondering about, what's the interest rate differential?
Depends on your term. I'll see if Peter has more of an comment.
Sure. Good question. So currently, the port keeps the variable rate bonds on the subordinate lien and the long-term fixed rate bonds on the senior lien. And you've done that intentionally. The credit spread, so let's start with what a AAA rated entity would receive. AAA rated entity, long-term fixed rate bonds, let's just look at the 10-year tax exempt rate, 1.56%. Okay, the 10-year, I'll say that again, the 10-year yield on a tax exempt bond is 1.56%. That's for a AAA issuer. Then what investors look for is, if compared to a AAA, if you're a AA minus, which the senior lien is, that might be a 25, they'll look for additional 25 basis points. You drop to the subordinate lien, they'll look for an additional 35 basis points. So it's beneficial for your long-term fixed rate bonds to be up there on the senior lien by 10 basis points compared to your subordinate lien. So from that perspective, makes sense to keep your long-term fixed rate bonds on the senior lien. Your variable rate bonds are on the subordinate lien. Those trade and reset every week. So that's a very short duration. It's literally reset every week. The weekly reset currently is at about 1.27%. The credit spread, which was dropping from 1.56 plus 20 plus 30 on the fixed rate bonds, the credit spread on weekly paper is 1 basis point or so. So if you're a AAA rated issuer and you're receiving 1.27% for a weekly, if you're a single A and on your subordinate lien, you're A+. So if you're an A+ issuer, instead of 1.27, you're paying 1.28 because the exposure that investor is looking at for a week is so low that there's a very, very low credit spread. So that's why you've put your variable rate debt on the subordinate lien, because you're paying very little for doing so compared to putting it on the senior lien.
Because the way I view senior lien is a stronger commitment relative to the debt service coverage, David, that
you have
about.
To have a higher debt service coverage. Yes. So the bondholders are more protected.
Yeah. I guess, thank you, by the way, sure. Peter. I guess the other comment I would have on this is that I very much favor competitive bid process, not a negotiated process, I think. And I understand, but I would suggest to you that if you go negotiate it, that at least we be apprised of any negotiations that's occurring.
Yes, sir.
Any other, Commissioner Mark?
Yeah, quick question, because I like the idea of trying to eliminate some of the risks we may have in the future. You've talked several times about the market conditions. So what's the trigger that says, okay, we're going to go forward, we're not, whatever?
Well, we will have a set date. I think our set date to offer our senior bonds is August 8th, plus or minus a couple days. So
great day.
We could start and plan to go, and a war could break out, or something could happen. All of a sudden, a bank could go bankrupt, and now people don't want to issue bonds, right? They're all afraid.
Interest rates could drop.
Interest rates. Well, but that's good news.
That's not
right?
Good either.
I be honest with you, we remember when we talked in 2016, we were hoping for bad news when we were issuing our refunding debt, because it would result
in... We want to strike that bad news part.
Yeah, but we don't want bad news, but bad news helps us when we're issuing debt.
Right.
And but fear causes higher interest rates. So that's what we'll be looking at as we approach the issuance of these bonds, okay. Commissioner.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions?
Question. The major benefit you've identified is risk reduction. And it seems like a lot of that is tied to the swap program that Port has.
Well, on the risk reduction, I'm really talking about the senior bonds, right? Short-term interest rates could stay where they are. They could go down to zero like they were in Germany and Japan, or they could shoot up to 8% like we saw in the Lehman's moment, right? I'm taking away variability of the interest paid on $41 million. That's the risk reduction I'm doing there. The other part that I'm recommending is that we're taking a known difference of 10% of LIBOR and eliminating that in expectations that we will pay total lower interest cost on our subordinate lien. It's a fixed known delta, and I'm trying to eliminate that.
And I learned a lot about swap since I didn't know the term swap or what it meant when I came on the Port Commission. I learned a lot from you and others, and I understand it's not a common method of finance in a lot of the port industry, but it's utilized some. And a lot of that, the history of it goes back to the port incurring a lot of debt and being highly leveraged, as I understand it. And as you know, my fundamental goal is to see the port debt reduced so that we're not the most highly leveraged major port on the West Coast. And so I'm trying to see how this step could lead us to ultimately a reduction in overall debt, other than the hopeful anticipation of not paying as much interest. How could this lead to the next, as I see it, step of a program to ultimately reduce that debt?
Well, as you know, we have a major capital improvement plan, right, and our contributions to the Northwest Seaport Alliance. So this was not designed to reduce our debt. I've certainly heard you, Commissioner, in your time on the board, that that's what you'd like to do. We certainly don't want to just pay down debt to have to turn around and issue more debt for the capital improvement plan. Where this may or may not help is, as you may remember, I mentioned that we will probably issue these bonds as premium bonds. So if I could, I'd like to issue the bonds. I'd like to issue exactly $41,630,000 of bonds at the very lowest coupon. So the bondholders who buy bonds out a year would get 0.5%, and the bond holders out 3 years will get 2%, you know, very low coupons. But bondholders like to have a big coupon. They like to have 5% coupon. And so when you're issuing bonds with a 5% coupon and current rates are 2%, you issue the bonds at a premium. So instead of selling a bond at $1,000 face value, I'll get $1,150. So you issue at a premium. So I can take $38 million worth of bonds and pay down $41 million worth of bonds because I'm getting extra money at premium. So there may be a $4 or $5 million reduction in our total principal amount outstanding, but this was not intended to do anything to reduce our overall debt. We just have the glide path we're doing. We pay $25 million a year in total, I guess that's including interest and principal on revenue bonds, and another $12 million a year on our GO bonds. But every year we're paying down debt. We're not increasing our debt or making our principal payments any bigger.
Just as a follow-up, if we were to have an overall debt reduction program that we adopted in the next few years, depending upon T5 development and other things, would the debt reduction occur then with the, I assume, whatever variable bonds were left then?
I don't think I have, yes. Well, right now, our bonds outstanding on the senior lien level that are callable are our 2014 bonds, which are callable now, and our 2016 bonds, which won't become callable until 2026. If someone handed me $10 million and say, we want you to pay down debt, mm-hmm. I'd be able to do that when this gap, excuse me, I pushed the wrong button, gets to $10 million. So I'm a little constrained by fixing out right now. So if you handed $10 million to me in the next year, right. I couldn't pay it down. No, I couldn't pay down subordinate. I could pay down portions of the 2014B senior. So there is still a little bit of flexibility on the senior. Now, 5 years from now, hand me $10 million, I would pay down part of the 2008B bonds, which is the $122 million that matures in 2044.
Couple more questions. I think I had been thinking of this in terms of an issuance of like in the 2% range, and I think you had mentioned today 2.25 to 2.5 is, and that's something that will be determined in August then?
Or? When we issue the senior, the current rates will dictate, market will dictate what rates we issue the senior bonds at. As I mentioned, the historical low over the last 10 years for double A 10-year paper was 1.9. We're at 2.0. Right. When PFM did a financial analysis, you add in all the interest costs, et cetera, will be, if you did it today, about 2.4 to 2.5. We have other senior bonds at 2.5, and we're glad to have them. There are 2014A and 2014B bonds. So there's the interest cost, and then you have to add in your total issuance cost, et cetera, so you know it all at total cost. So the interest rates will probably be around the 2%, and then total costs will bring us up to 2.4-ish.
Okay. Some of these resolutions seem to give you, and I think the term you used was flexibility and options, depending upon how things roll out. Will any of these options come back to the Port Commission for decision on, or are these resolutions drafted in a way that we've given you full authority as to which option to take, for example?
So let's talk about that. For, the 2008 and 2008B bonds, I already, as treasurer, have been delegated authority to change those interest rates. I could go from a weekly, I could change them to monthly, I could change them to a long term. Those have been delegated authority, so there's nothing new in those two resolutions other than allowing me the ability to have some as weekly and some fixed rate. And that's to help manage that gap in the future if interest rates are capable. In terms of issuance, yes, you're giving me the authority to go, let me move to the 2019 bonds, right? The subordinate lien bonds will have that same authority as the 2008 and 2008B, but I'm also able to go issue the bonds and pay the debt. So as I mentioned, we have issued an RFP for letter of credit banks. But if something happens, I could go negotiate directly. We're using the results of the LOC request for proposals to drive the costs. So no, at this point, there's nothing I'm coming back to you that I can think of, bond counsel, that's giving to me the authority to go execute these transactions. I cannot issue additional debt, but I'm going to execute these transactions.
And you're not going on vacation anytime soon.
And I'd like to keep my job, Commissioner. So like I did in March, I came and presented to you these options. And we've sent memos over time. I know you enjoyed the 3-inch binder of four resolutions, an official statement, a cost estimate, and other stuff. So I do plan to keep you informed. I will come back and report to you how we performed when we go issue these bonds. I will report to you the banks that were selected as our remarketing agents and our letter of credit providers and what happened in the competitive bid for the senior bonds.
Great. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Any comments or questions from the audience? Please, name and address and comment.
Dave Bryant, citizen of Pierce County. Just a simple question. The exposure, and I guess this is long-term, do you have a number for the potential exposure that the citizens of Pierce County would have if we had runaway inflation? Obviously, our Federal Reserve is doing their darndest to make sure we don't, But if we did and we got back to where we were in the 70s with LIBOR rates in the mid to high teens, what kind of exposure would the citizens of Pierce County have? Have you done any of those calculations?
Sir, these are revenue bonds. They are only guaranteed by the revenue from the port, not the tax levy. So in my mind, the citizens don't have that risk. In fact, tax levy money cannot be used to pay revenue bond interest and principal. So there is risk to the business of the port. If inflation went wild, then we'd have variable interest rates of 10%, but our swaps, we'd be receiving that. So that's what the swaps do, is they mitigated that risk and tried to turn variable rate into fixed rates. In terms of what's called asset liability management, and Commissioner Meyer was getting that, we have money in the bank that's also at a variable rate because it's short rate investments. And our minimum cash, as you remember, is about $60 million. About $30 million is invested in the five-year range, about $15 million a little bit longer, but we have 10 to 20, $30 million, and right now we have a lot more because we're getting ready for the CIP, in short-term money that's earning 2 and 2.5%. If interest rates shot up, it would lag a little bit, but we would earn that same rate on our investments, commissioners.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from the audience? Hearing none, we have a motion and a second on the subject. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody against, say nay. Motion passes. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, David. Commissioners. I thank will be you, back Cynthia. With my report.
Peter?
Yeah,
I thought we'd get another 300 pages on that book.
No more 300 pages, commissioners. Thank you.
One of the things, too, is that history is an indication of all the work that David has done with staff and everything else. It's a reflection on the job that you do to help protect our financial interests, and we really appreciate that.
I second that tremendously.
We do, and we hope you brought your van today so you can pick up our binders.
He needs a dolly.
He needs a dolly.
Okay, next up is Carolyn Lake, legal counsel. We're going to talk about public records.
Thank you, commissioners. Yes, I'm Carolyn Lake, court general counsel, and I'm talking to you about a different kind of swap. This is, we are requesting your approval of a resolution that would appoint Erin Galino, Chief Financial Administrative Officer, or her designees, and her designees rather, as the new Port of Tacoma Public Records Officer. As you know, the Port is required to appoint and publicly identify a public records officer pursuant to state law, and our public records officer serves as the point of contact to members of the public in requesting disclosure of public records and oversees the Port's compliance with Public Records Act requirements. Currently, our public records officer was Debbie Givens. She was the director of systems and business processes information technology. She served the port ably and she retired, meaning we need to appoint a new public records officer. So by adopting this resolution, the commission would be appointing Erin Galino, Chief Financial Administrative Officer, and her designees as the new Port of Tacoma Public Records Officer.
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Any questions or comments?
Question. Do we, it's not, the question not relative to this appointment. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, as you say, we have to appoint someone. And but it's, do we have a policy in place with regard to how public records requests are handled by the Port of Tacoma? Is there an actual policy in
place? Most definitely. We do have a policy. We have both policies and procedures, and those are posted on our website, as well as there is a really amazing NEX request, electronic public records system.
Is that policy and procedure essentially the same that all public entities do, or are there differences?
There are slight nuances. Right. As you may know, the AG has a model rules for public records processing, and ours are very much consistent with that, with, I would say, very minimal change deviations.
I have one particular question relative to policy and procedure. Do we have a policy and procedure that deals with a public record request if it's related to a port employee, be they at any level? Do we have a policy or procedure that requires notification of the employee?
I don't believe that we treat records requested of public employees any differently than records requested, other types of records request. However, we do have a process that calls for what's called third-party notification. So if we believe either the employee, if it's an employee-related request, or if it's maybe a business customer request, if we believe that they would have an interest and potentially an ability to protect under trade secrets or something else, we do provide third-party notification. We give them a defined period of time in which to seek relief from our being able to release those. We do not undertake to take on that action to not allow the records to become public. We have that placed on the third party because that's where the responsibility lies. And if they do not come back to us with a court order which prevents release, we do release the records.
Okay. How about former employees? Do we have a similar?
It would be the same process. Policy.
Okay. Thank you, Carol.
Yep.
Any other questions or comments from the commission? Hearing none, any questions or comments from the audience? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion on the floor, please say aye.
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 Anybody against? Nay? Motion passes. Thank
Congratulations,
you
Aaron.
Yeah. Okay, Scott, you're up. We're going to talk about Alexander Avenue. Phil.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm here to request additional project authorization in the amount of $212,000 for a total amount of $462,000 for the Taylor Way and Alexander Avenue Fill Area Landfill, Master ID 101082. So Port Parcel 117, along with several others, is part of a 50-acre cleanup site, once known as the Don Olin Landfill, now referred to by ecology as the Taylor Way and Alexander Avenue Fill Area Landfill. And it's been contaminated by fill that was entrained in the fill. Most of the contamination originated from Occidental Chemical and from General Metals in the form of lime solvent sludge and auto fluff, as well as releases from two hazardous waste or dangerous waste facilities that were subsequently constructed on the property. The PLPs include the former landfill owner, Occidental Chemical, General Metals, Stericycle, Clean Care, and the port. This shows the location of the landfill. It's centrally located in the Blair-Hylabos Peninsula.
Could I ask a question? When you mentioned port in terms of PLP, we never operated on this site, did we? I just want to be really clear about this.
Our liability stems solely from ownership of property.
Okay, we're not in the same category, I think, as the other folks that you mentioned. Okay.
We cause no releases of hazardous materials, nor do we profit from entities that release hazardous materials.
Okay, thank you.
So does that mean we're not going to be faced with a huge bill?
No.
I keep looking at this $400,000 max, and I said, that's a real small number compared to what we might be looking at in a few years.
That's correct, Commissioner.
As long as we don't get our hopes too high here.
No, but I think from a public perception standpoint, when people hear that the port is named in the same way that the operators and those other folks, that sends kind of shivers through my spine. And I want to be really clear, we bought this property under the pretense of basically saying it was a part of another deal, and the deal never happened.
No good deed ever goes unpunished, and it's always deep pockets.
Yeah. So I'm just, that's why I raised that question.
And if I could, because I couldn't agree more with Don. You know, the average citizen, and I'll talk to people, even co-workers and stuff, they'll say, what did we do on that property?
Yeah.
I said, well, we haven't done anything.
Yeah, that's so right.
We purchased the property several years ago, and this is what we're trying to do now. So
this job involves sweeping up a lot of broken glass.
Yeah. Please continue. We're going to sit here and complain for a while, but please continue.
Okay.
We are where we are.
So,
I just want to be clear about where we are.
It's not good.
I had some comments, but I'll hold those there.
Wise choice, John.
So in 2016, about 8 years after Ecology issued its last PLP notice letter, Ecology invited the PLPs to sit down to discuss an agreed order that would define the extent of contamination and develop a remedy to clean it up. Four of the PLPs, the Port, General Metals, Occidental, and Stericycle, entered into a joint defense and cost-sharing agreement. One element of that was to develop a work plan that would fill the data gaps for the remedial investigation, the rationale being that by having that document approved by Ecology, the partners would have the PLP group would have much more certainty on the implementation costs associated with that agreed order. After at least three iterations of comment and review by Ecology, that work plan was submitted to Ecology in January. And at about that time, the PLPs were notified by Ecology that due to a series of retirements and reassignments, they no longer had the bandwidth to either approve the work plan or to respond to the PLP's comments on the agreed order. And so we were motivated to move forward with Parcel 117 because it's adjacent to a number of other undeveloped sites, roughly an assemblage of roughly 30 acres of undeveloped property that represents one of our last good redevelopment opportunities on the Blair-Hylabos Peninsula. So we talked to Ecology about the potential of moving forward with the work under the work plan as an independent action, and I think in no small part due to the site manager's reputation for risk adversity and attention to detail, Ecology agreed to allow us to move forward with this work as an independent action. So this work will support our efforts to redevelop Parcel 117, and ultimately, when that agreed order is in place, we'll be required to do it anyway. So this is a close-up of the properties that are involved in the landfill, as well as the properties that we'd like to redevelop and bring to market. The property in the upper right-hand corner was remediated under an interim action by Avenue 55 under the terms of their lease agreement. And you can see some brand new Class A office space or warehouse space that opened earlier this year that was constructed as part of the remediation. By the way, all the port-owned properties are shown in green within the red area. The others are not. In the lower right-hand corner is Handen Containers. The port purchased that property in 2008. They've before the purchase and after the purchase, they fixed chassis and containers. And then Parcel 117 to the left, the subject of this request, was purchased from the City of Tacoma in 2008 for roughly $3 million. It was roughly half of the market rate at the time because there was a consent decree to discharge the City of Tacoma's natural resource damage assessment liability for the Commencement Bay cleanup. And we were able to transfer that liability to Parcel 88, the place of circling waters remediation site, so that we could remove that encumbrance and allow Parcel 117 to be redeveloped. Shown in gray are the two dangerous waste facilities. And then if you start with Parcel 117 and you move to the left, that's the 30-acre group of properties that we'd like to get to market to redevelop. And I'm also showing another cleanup site in yellow that's not part of the landfill, but that will also have to be addressed as part of the redevelopment action. So we've done a lot of work before coming to you today. We've entered into an agreed order to remediate 1514 Taylor Way as part of the tenant's lease. That work is nearly complete. We're about to close out the agreed order to negotiate an agreement with the other PLPs to share costs and to defend each other. That agreement's been in place some time ago. And of course, the agreed order with Ecology and approval of the data gap work plan is on hold pending their staff augmentation efforts. This authorization allows us to perform an extensive soil and groundwater assessment for the various chemicals that have been found in the landfill. I won't read through all of that.
Good.
This is a picture facing the Blair-Hylabos facing the Hylabos waterway. And I just wanted to point out a couple of things. The fence line along the right demarcates the adjacent Stericycle facility. And the issue of concern to Ecology are those hummocks of fill that are along the fence line. Now, there is some groundwater contamination at this site. A lot of soil testing has been done. No hazardous substances in soil have ever been documented at this site. Nevertheless, Ecology has listed this property as part of the agreed order. And so by doing this testing, if we don't find hazardous substances, then that would support removing this property from the agreed order. If we do find contamination, then we'll need to develop a plan to address that as part of the development of the property. Just as an aside, the north end of the peninsula has been subject to an eradication effort for Mediterranean vineyard snails in cooperation with the FDA and the State Department of Agriculture. It's been a problem in Australia and anywhere where you grow wheat. And over the last 10 years, after expending more than $1 million, we've reduced the area of infestation to one property, and it's this property. So redevelopment of this property would be able to put the nail in the coffin to the invasive species issue.
Hey, Scott, real quickly, on the as you examine the property stuff, what's the time frame of coming back and saying, yes, there is no hazardous material that we can find here, or there is, or?
Sure. The plan is to use our on-call consulting to get out there and implement this work later this year, so that we'll have a report together that we can get in front of ecology first quarter of next year. So we'll know by the end of the year if this action is approved.
Okay.
So the capital improvement plan allocates $774,000 for this project. The costs are expensed and included in the operating budget. Cost to date, we're in it for a little over $200,000. Roughly $35,000 of that represents our 25% share in development of the work plan. About $65,000 in attorney's fees. The rest are staff costs. And remaining cost is forecast at $260,000. So the plan is to use our on-call consultant, get out there and drill this year, and get in front of ecology with a report early next year. So in conclusion, I'm requesting project authorization in the amount of $212,000 for a total authorized amount of $462,000 for the Taylor Way and Alexander Avenue fill area, master identification number 101082.01.
Thank you. May I have a motion?
So move.
Okay. Seconded.
Got a motion and a second. Any questions from the commission? John?
Question. My questions have to do with what's been spent, what's going to be spent, and the fact that, you know, we have the policy in place that requires projects costs exceeding $300,000 to be approved by the commission. So you just mentioned, I didn't see it in the paper, but you just mentioned, Scott, in your presentation, the breakdown of what we've spent so far, $250,000 requested, $201,000 cost to date. Where did the money go? Where's the money gone that we've spent?
What did we do?
What did you spend it on? Who got the money?
Half of it was staff time. That's internal court staff.
Sure.
The attorney's fees were Coastline Law.
Okay.
Okay. And $35,000 in consultant fees. That represented our 25% share of the cost to develop that work plan.
25%, and the other 75% is being
was borne by the other parties.
I see.
And the reason that Dalton Olmsted and Fugovan was used to develop that work plan is because they are Stericycle's consultant, and the PLP group recognized that they have more on the ground knowledge than bringing somebody else up to speed, and would be in the best position to develop that work plan cost effectively, notwithstanding the fact it cost $140,000 to do.
Do you have an obligation to do a request for proposals or a public call for bids with regard to any of this work?
No, it came out of the joint defense agreement, so it was essentially a legal obligation, as I understand it.
The joint defense agreement with the other?
With the other PLPs.
I see. I don't know, I'm kind of looking to Carolyn. Is that, we have no obligation to call for bids, you know, if we're part of a larger group that's paying for these costs as a public entity?
I'm going to have to check on the history of that, because it may well be that was sought. I don't have an answer for you today, okay, but we'll certainly get one to you.
All right. And the rest of the money that's going to be spent that we're authorizing today, which is $212,000, who's going to get that money?
We've got four on-call consultants, on-call agreements, so we currently selected Crete to perform that work because of the four on-call environmental consultants we have in place. the spending right. level is lowest with them.
Sure. This isn't necessarily directed to you, but it's to Eric and others. We've had some discussions with regard to our master policy direction to clarify and make clear that if we think a project or a contract is going to end up being over $300,000, to bring it to the commission before it gets close to that, because oftentimes you get involved in a project. In this case, you spent $250,000. So what the commission is going to say when you want to spend some more to finish the job? They're tied in. So back at the time, it's anticipated that costs are going to go over $300,000. I think it's the time I and perhaps others want to hear about it.
Yes, Commissioner. In fact, there will be several trips to the commission associated with this project in the future, including the next agreed order with Ecology.
I see.
An implementation agreement with the other PLPs for the costs associated with that agreed order. And sure. then finally, an authorization increase for the cost associated with doing the work on the ground. Right.
So if we authorize this today, then you can still proceed with kind of reviewing if we're in compliance with competitive call for bids, et cetera. Okay. Thank you. I have no other questions.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Scott, can you go back to the slide where you show two monitoring wells?
Sure.
I thought there was a reference, in at least in material I read, that the monitoring wells are not functioning the way that they should be functioning. And so I guess my question is who basically put in the wells, and why aren't they functioning?
So the issue that Ecology pointed out with a couple of the wells is that the well screens were long. And what?
So they were what?
Let me answer it this way. When you think of the geology at this site, it's a bit like a layer cake. There's a shallow, intermediate, and a deep aquifer.
Okay.
And the concern that that Ecology had with a couple of the screens is that they were drilled into both the shallow and the intermediate aquifer. So the water samples that were withdrawn from those wells, it wasn't absolutely clear whether it represented water quality in the upper aquifer or the intermediate aquifer. And for those reasons, they'd like those wells destroyed and replaced with wells that they have a greater degree of confidence sample the upper aquifer and the intermediate aquifer.
Who put those wells in? I guess
I don't remember. I think they've been there since 2008. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm always concerned about if they're not functioning, and we already spent that amount of money. That's not exactly the position we want to be in.
Well, I think the word is the wrong word. They're functioning all right. They're just not measuring what they want to see.
That's right.
Okay, but that gets me to my second part of my question, which is when you say independent action, I normally use the terms voluntary and non-voluntary or whatever. So this independent action we're taking, how do we know we aren't going to be drilling wells that Ecology is going to say they're in the wrong place or they're not at the right depth or whatever? I'm concerned about that. You know, I don't mind, by the way, I'll support this action, but I just want to make doggone certain that we don't end up putting wells either in the wrong place or not deep enough or too deep. So that's the reason for my question. And what assurances can you give us that we're not going to have that same thing repeated?
I
think I'd address that by saying that it wasn't easy getting the work plan to the place that it is today. You know, it went through at least three iterations of detailed comments, meetings, reviews, and revisions with Ecology, with one of the most detail-oriented and risk-averse individuals at that time on Ecology's staff. And I think for that reason, the Ecology site manager had confidence that it's unlikely that something more would be required, although depending on the findings, that's always a risk. So yes, that risk is real.
Yeah, and I guess I'm very concerned because basically, at least as I interpreted what you were saying is, because of the workload at Ecology, they don't have anybody to oversee this project. And therefore, we're going to spend some money here, and we may or may not hit the right thing on the monitoring well, or maybe some other actions that I'm not familiar with. That's a real problem for me. I'll support this activity, but I'm hoping that someone is working very closely with Ecology so we don't miss the mark and waste scarce resources.
Let's say
absolutely, Commissioner. I can only respond by saying that's a risk with any assessment of this nature.
Let's see if my summary works. We have a plan that Ecology bought off on after many after many hours of investigation, Ecology was part of the design level for the new wells, and their staffing issue is a current issue. It wasn't during the design of the capital of the project, and so the staffing shortage can go on another issue, but had nothing to do with developing this plan. So right now, Ecology and everybody on board agrees to the plan. Now, the plan could change depending on what you find, but that's a risk we have with everything.
That's an excellent summary, Commissioner Johnson. I wish I would have summarized it that way.
Thank you. we make things too complicated sometimes.
I think it just covered your bases for you. That's what I think. But I'll tell you, there's still that risk, and I'm very concerned about
risk.
It. No, but what I'm trying to say, though, is that there's always risk. But as I understand it, Ecology has basically backed away from this, saying go forward. And that just bothers me.
Well, I think that's wrong, too, isn't it? Yeah. If we go forward with this project, we're going to have to do this research project anyway. That's been my experience. We're going to have to go out and dig holes and find out what we got down there before we can develop that property. So we have no choice.
That's right. And it puts us in a different footing with the discussion with the other PLPs when it comes time to implement the rest of it, because we'll be able to say, share this 25%. We've already done it.
Now you know what you're talking about versus the what ifs.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other comments from the commission? Any comments or questions from the audience? Hearing none, we have a motion, a second on the... Are you done?
I'm done.
we have a motion. Summary.
I'm doing summary work. We have a motion, a second on the agenda. So all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Anybody against, say nay. We are frustrated where this is going to lead us down. We're going to see some big numbers eventually down the road, I think. So.
Thank you, commissioners.
It passes. Thank you very much.
More surprised if we don't.
Yeah. It's going to be a long-term issue.
John, I'm wondering if the city put those wells in.
You know, I'm hoping they did, because my main concern is, the wells are the wells, but it's just that.
If you wait 15 years before you do something, you're going to get another request.
Oh, yeah.
Leslie Barstow, we're going to talk about local economic development investment fund.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Leslie Barstow, Community Relations Manager for the Port of Tacoma. I'm here today to request approval of the funding recommendations provided by the Local Economic Development Investment Fund Program Review Committee. That's for the year of 2019. For a total authorized amount of $197,500, funding of $250,000 for these investments was included in the port's 2019 non-operating budget. This chart provides a list of the organizations and projects the review committee found met the application criteria for the Local Economic Development Investment Fund. You will recall that the fund's policy limits our investments to county, city, and town governments, nonprofits in Pierce County, and typically it involves the port being a minority investor. Investment focuses and priorities are road, freight, and rail infrastructure, projects that are creating long-term jobs, marine tourism infrastructure, projects intended to attract tourists to Pierce County from outside locations, planning activities or events promoting international trade, or planning activities and events promoting tourism that are intended to attract tourists to Pierce County from an outside location. Again, the $250,000 in the Local Economic Development Fund is part of the 2019 non-operating budget. So at this time, I ask your approval. Oops, it went away. I don't know where it went. Of the funding recommendations that were provided by the Local Economic Development Investment Fund Program Committee for 2019 for a total authorized amount of $197,500.
So moved.
Second.
You got a motion and a second. A comment. I want to thank Commissioner John McCarthy and Commissioner Claire Petridge for participating on this committee. It's a lot of work. I saw the work. It was just a lot of good stuff, a lot of good work. Any comments or questions from the commission?
Thank you for that. Just a comment. I wanted to reassure you that we did spend a long time vetting the applications. As you may recall, a year ago, we rewrote the policy and priorities and procedures and made it, in my opinion, a much better plan. The recommendations that we've made fall $53,000 below the budgeted amount that the commission authorized. And through a lot of discussions, we strongly believe, and Commissioner Petrich and I were in favor of the recommendations to the full commission. Great.
Any other comments?
I think Don had something.
Yeah, I also echo the comments that Commissioner Johnson expressed in terms of your involvement, Claire's as well. But also I want to say thank you to staff, because I think when we talk about partnerships in the community, we talk about economic development in a broader context and the role that the port plays. This is one of the ways that we do that. And by the way, just so that everybody understands, the Local Economic Development Investment Fund, what was it, 2 years ago, was at $35,000. We increased it to the $250,000 level. So this, I think, is a great example of how we're trying to reach out in the community, form partnerships that are meaningful to the various communities. And I will say that it was a joy, I think it was 2 years ago, where we provided a little bit of money for the town of Wilkerson, I think it was, and for tourism. And I will tell you, I went up there on the night that they were celebrating it, and I was very proud of the Port of Tacoma's investment. Small amount of investment, but a huge impact for the local community.
I guess the comment I have, I want to thank team again for doing that, because this is a huge task and there's no wrong answer. There's better answers, but there's no wrong answer. And it's 75% infrastructure and 25% for the community. And with my old job, you're always surprised what $1,000 can do for a small organization outside the mainstream.
Right.
It just makes their life exist, and so many people participate in those small things. It just does great things for small communities that who cannot come up with that kind of money. So it's a great investment. And one of the things we might want to take a look at doing as we go forward is, let's take the $50,000 that wasn't spent. I get concerned about these things because government sometimes have the money. So if you don't spend it, you'll lose it. That is, in my view, I'll clean this up, a poor risk. I mean, it's a poor decision. I think there might be times as we go forward, and I won't be here, but if we authorize that $250 a year, if we don't spend the $250, that money can go forward, or you don't have to authorize projects just because you got to spend the money. We should be able to find a way to accumulate those funds so we can actually do a big project that has meaning. You know, a $5 million project. You know, in 10 years' time, $50,000 a year adds up to something we might want to be able to do.
That money is.
I'm sorry, Leslie.
I was just going to say, Commissioner Johnson, that money is also, because it was budgeted for 2019, available if something comes along during the rest of the year that you're interested in participating in. So that's still in the budget.
Yeah, I understand that. But John?
Just a. And we kind of got a late start this year because we were changing the policy, et cetera. So you can anticipate next year that we'll have the applications and recommendations well before July. So.
Great.
Just a couple quick comments, because I fully support the program that was adopted and the adjustment that was made a few years ago. Two quick things. One is that this all falls under RCW, so we're not doing anything outside of the realm. And to give an idea of what homework we get, I brought my binder that you can then have back with all of the applicants. And they're all well worthy of receiving stuff. I appreciate the efforts that John and Claire and all staff have done providing the request for the people that have been chosen or the groups that have been chosen. But it is a way to reach out to our community and get more involved with regards to that. So just want to make sure that everybody knew we have homework.
I brought mine, too.
A lot of good. You can have mine now.
I have to wait for Dave's van to show up.
And one more point, because things come up all the time, especially from an infrastructure. If we know something's going to come up a couple of years from now, we can save funds and do that. So any other comments from the commission? Any comments from the floor? Seeing none, all those in favor of the proposal of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Anybody against, say nay. Motion passes. Thank you very much for a great job. Okay, we're down to general business. Eric?
Commissioners, thank you. I'm going to stand here to give my remarks because I feel more comfortable standing up when I talk. So that's just my style. 5 weeks into the job, and I'm still...
Seems like 20 years already.
Yeah. I've noticed several more gray hairs in the mirror. The fire hose I'm drinking out of is a little smaller than it was 4 weeks ago, so there's a little bit of progress being made, but I'm still very, very busy learning about the port, getting briefings, starting to get out in the community and meet people. Everything's going fine is the short report. I've got a few things I want to talk about in general, but big picture, the staff remains extremely committed to getting me onboarded. I'm having no problem getting access to all the information I need. And everybody's just been extremely welcoming and professional. And I want to actually comment just briefly that last little program that you just approved. That's a good program, and you're not the first port to do that. The Port of Bellingham, actually, and usually it's a countywide port that starts to think about this, because it's common for a countywide port to have some community like Rainier or Ording say, you know, what are you doing out here for us in the more remote or rural areas of the county? And so the Port of Bellingham actually began a program very much like the one you have probably about 10 years ago. And some other ports looked at that. Port of Olympia looked at that and said, we like that. They kind of patterned theirs after Bellingham. Seattle has done some work with tourism promotion with different programs. But I like the fact that you guys have created criteria that relate to economic development and infrastructure. I think that's helpful. You have to be careful with those sorts of programs that you're not giving it to, you know, a program that doesn't quite fit into what RCW 53 lets us do. But I'm really comfortable with the criteria that you guys developed. I think you did a good job. I think that's going to be a program that you're going to be really happy with as time goes on. Announcements, July 28th, which I think is a week from this coming Sunday, we are doing the annual boat tours. And I think we are nearly full. The tours are pretty much booked. We've got six tours booked, hour each. The staff is set up to we've got docents, we've got narrators, we've got an on-the-ground presence there on the plaza outside the Foss Waterway Authority, information booth, place to take pictures. There's a container, and so it should be a good opportunity. I'm going to be there all day long, that'll be a fun thing. One of the things, I'm changing the subjects on you now, one of the things that has happened to me a couple of times in the last 5 weeks is that I'm getting requests for either sister ports or friendship ports to renew their understandings with the Port of Tacoma. And it led me to ask, how many sister ports do we have and who are they? And it looked to me like we could probably use what I'm going to call a policy review or strategic look at who our sister ports and friendship ports are. And what, you know, whether we need to line up our business opportunities and so on with some of the folks that we're working on. So it's evolved over a long time. Some of the sister ports we haven't had any interaction with for a long time, and I haven't found anybody yet who could answer the trivia question of, can you name all six? So and I couldn't have ahead of time. I think Commissioner McCarthy can now. I just want to give you a heads up that I'm starting to think about that. I think I'll come forward with a more formed recommendation to you, and would probably welcome Commission involvement in thinking that through. And by the way, one of our friendship ports, I believe, will be here today. I don't see them right now, but the Port of Fuzhou in China is a sister city with the city of Tacoma. And that's one of the people that has reached out to us. And I'm going to be meeting with some of their representatives after this, but making no commitments right now. We may do that later. Changing the subject again on you, I want to give you just a very brief overview of the Tide Flats sub-area planning process that you all have been more or less involved in for the last year and a half or so since that began. You've got a work plan that you negotiated that's rather complicated and detailed with the other four partners. And the first meeting of the steering committee of that group was held about 2 weeks ago. There's not another one scheduled yet. There was some direction given to the planning staff to come back to the group with some additional recommendations that generated some concerns from the port. But at this moment in time, I don't really have anything to report to you that's an action item for you. What you need to know is that we're continuing to be engaged in that process. Our two representatives, Commissioners Petrich and McCarthy, remain engaged. working with me, working with staff, and things seem to be moving relatively slowly. I don't expect there is going to be anything dramatic happening over the next month or two, and there are not even any steering committee meetings scheduled yet for the remainder of the year. I think there will be one, but they're not even at the point where they say, where we have a date for it. So there are some staff meetings going on at the planning level, but there's no big picture announcement for you right now. I think you will be getting some additional briefing from us probably over the next month as things start to settle out just a little bit. When I've got some news for you, we'll give you the news. But right now, there's not enough news to really dive into that. Any questions about that?
Could I ask just one question?
Sure.
As I recall, there was an expectation that a big part of this year would be devoted to the selection of a consultant.
Yes.
Is that process underway to help that move forward? Does anybody know?
Yeah, Commissioner Meyer, the process is on paper is underway, but I don't even think the leadership committee or the staff committee have begun the process yet of talking about that RFP. I think the city of Tacoma, it's my understanding, has a draft RFP in the process within their world, within their, probably their HR.
But that department. Hasn't been issued yet. Huh?
But it has not been issued yet, no. And I believe that the port staff have seen that RFP. We have not provided input, yeah. They've given us the RFP, but we haven't responded. We haven't marked it up yet.
Okay.
So
thank you.
Small steps, but we have a little work to go.
Yeah.
And then finally, last thing, sometime in the last few months, the University of Washington Tacoma did a study session with some students looking at different issues down in the Tide Flats. They presented those work projects to two commissioners, I believe, Commissioner Meyer and Commissioner Petrich. And Commissioner Petrich wanted to have a work session with the University of Washington Tacoma to follow up on some of those. And she would like to schedule that for August 7th. So we have tentatively scheduled a work session, no action to be taken, just a study session, basically, to hear some of the student projects from the University of Washington Tacoma. Along those lines, I will jump ahead and tell you that it occurs to me that as the port begins thinking about its strategic plan, which is one of the things that's on my short list of things to get started on, it probably would be a good idea to have a part of that strategic plan be, have us think through what is our profile and interaction process and need look like with the educational institutions of Pierce County. So there are a number of colleges and universities and programs in Pierce County that do workforce training, higher ed, all that sort of thing. And most of the interactions that we have with higher ed, as I look at it, have been them coming to us and asking to get involved or partner with them on various things. And it might be beneficial as part of that process for us to think about what we need so that we can put together some principles or factors in our strategic plan that help us all think about how we're going to interact with those institutions and what we would like to see. It also will give them a little bit of a clue as to what sort of partnerships we're looking for, which might inform their and influence their requests or asks of us. So a preview of coming attractions, but I think it's one of the things that we might want to think about as we develop a plan. So with that, I'm done, unless you have questions.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, let's we're up to a commissioner comments.
A couple of comments. I think Eric covered the sub-area planning process. I do think we're hoping that things move forward in the near term to get the consultant on board and also to identify the stakeholders. I know there's draft letters that the planning committee's been working on with regard to solicitation of who those stakeholders would be. I guess my only comment, as Eric mentioned, is we deem it important that we stick with the work plan that we approved and we negotiated. And so we're attempting to make sure in our conversations with steering committee and others that the work plan is adhered to as a priority before our discussions on other issues. That's kind of a focus there. A couple other things I wanted to, just about last week, Sean Egan was involved, Tacoma Rail was involved,
Seaport, Northwest Seaport Alliance and the Port of Tacoma, in having, let's say, Sean, about 10 legislators come down and tour Tacoma Rail and the Port of Tacoma. And we had some long discussions with legislators on issues that had come up during the legislative session. I thought they were very successful. We had some of the leaders. We had two leaders of one of the most significant committees that we deal with in Olympia. So that was, I thought, very successful. I know there's also a lot of meetings scheduled in the near future with other legislators, other tours, other visits, the conversations of those West and East Side legislators. The other thing I wanted to mention, at the end of last month, I attended my first Pacific Northwest Waterways Association meeting down in Southern Washington. And I tell you, it was a really an informative program with a lot of good information that I thought was really helpful.
Very good.
I guess I have one comment. It's a follow-up from Eric's suggestion regarding a better plan for how we get involved with education, because part of it for me is, and I don't know if this is exactly right, but there was legislation that was passed relative to workforce development that ports were authorized to get involved with. And what I don't want to see is we react to requests rather than having a comprehensive program. And I think we need to develop some criteria. So I guess, Eric, I'm really looking forward to the day when we have that conversation. But also, I hope in the fairly near future, we develop some kind of a game plan in terms of our overall strategic plan process and what that timeline might look like. I don't want to put a lot of pressure on you, but I want to also say that I feel a real priority. In fact, I went back and looked at the last strategic plan we did, and it was interesting. I thought it was very well done because I actually could understand it. And it had 10 goals, if you'll remember, in 10 years. And it was very helpful to me just to review that. So what I'm trying to say is some of this will get caught up in the budgeting process, but the budgeting process shouldn't just be the leader relative to the strategic planning process. And so I would, if there's one thing that I would like to be an advocate for, is we need to figure out a timeline that you feel comfortable, Eric, with, that makes some sense based upon what you now know a little bit about the organization and some of the issues you've alluded to already.
I just want to add a little bit. You know, all strategic plans have to have an implementation plan. So anybody can sit back and dream and wish. Any effective strategic plan, and on the last one, we had a book about this thick with how we were going to get that job done, and people were assigned various functions to get done. Mm-hmm. So when we do the next one, we have to have the same process where we have, okay, that's great. How are we going to get that job? Who's going to do what? And have those details. Otherwise, it's just an exercise in wishing. So with that in mind, Dick?
Yeah, just a couple of quick things, because I agree with what both Dons have said with regards to strategic plan. The higher education program, I'm looking forward to that. I think it's something we need to develop, not just strictly for the higher education, i.e. the University of Washington, PLU, UPS, things of that nature, but on the high school level, too.
That's a problem.
And our Volk schools. You know, there's going to be, as we continue to grow, more job opportunities and skills that are going to be required. And there are young men and women out there that are going to be out in the workforce that are going to look at what they can do. And I think if we can kind of introduce them to the Volk schools and the different things that are going to be required down here, we're going to see a better opportunity for those individuals to get good family wage jobs.
Very good. We've all made a comment. It is now 1:38 by my Dick Tracy watch. And we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Okay.